We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Today, an interview with Sunitha Badiga of La Mala Soul Bakery, and short stories featuring the theme Speaking Up. We start the show with a short story by Steve Payne called Laffer. Then after the interview, a story by Helen Torres called Speaking Up. And then a story by Gray Delisle Griffin called Finding My Voice. Helen Torres and Gray Delisle Griffin are part of an event put on by the Passionistas Project on January 17, 2021, to celebrate the inauguration of our country's first female multiracial vice president, Kamala Harris. And also a musical remembrance of Claude Bowling, who sadly just passed away. Stay tuned.
Every now and again in life, a situation occurs where you think, oh God, I wish I'd done something. And you usually don't. You usually think about it 2 or 3 minutes later and it's too late. But something occurred to me and I did do something, and it still cracks me up to this day. About 20 years ago, I was working for a financial company doing some video, and we were shooting in Scottsdale, Arizona at their annual conference get-together thing. And it was a bunch of financial-centered people having a good time for a weekend, and I was just making a little film about them having a good time to show towards the end of the conference. And I did, and it worked out great. Everyone loved it. That was that. But the keynote speaker for that evening was a chap named Arthur Laffer. Now, Arthur Laffer was Ronald Reagan's financial go-to guy. He created Reaganomics, the trickle-down economy, and the Laffer curve. Now, trickle-down economics basically means that if you give big tax breaks to the rich people, they'll take that money and they'll build factories and they'll pay people more and everyone's going to do great. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. It's never worked and it never will work, because once the rich people get rich, They like money, and they like more money. They just want more money. They can't have enough money. There's no trickle-down anything. And that's how society works, unfortunately. So Arthur Laffer gave his speech, and afterwards I packed up all my gear and started heading back to the little cottage that I had rented for me. As I was walking back, I passed a bar at the hotel, and there, sitting all alone at the bar, was Arthur Laffer. And I just had to go and, you know, sit somewhere near him. And so I did. I sat a seat away from him, and we acknowledged each other and made a little small talk about the weather in Scottsdale and blah, 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 you know. And I think he even bought me a drink. I talked about what I'd done, and he had seen my little video presentation, and I told him I found his speech interesting. And he was like, oh, you know, glad you liked it. And I said, well, not so fast, really. I wouldn't go so far as to say I liked it. And I sort of tweaked his attention a little bit, and I said, well, basically, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. The Laffer curve, Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, it doesn't work. And he was like, well, and I said, watch, I'll show you. So I said, if I gave you $10,000 in a briefcase right now, just gave it to you, what would you do with it? And he thought for a moment, and he's like, well, I'd probably invest it, and, you know, that was about it, really. He'd invest it, which is fine, but that's just really to make him more money. He's not investing it for the good of society. So I turned to the bartender, and I said, excuse me, can I ask you a quick question? Hypothetically, if I gave you a suitcase of $10,000, what would you do with it? And she said, well, I'm a single mother. I've got a couple of kids, and I'm a little bit behind with the rent, and my car needs repairing, and I haven't been back to see my parents for a while. And I've got things I'd spend it on. And I turned around to Arthur Laffer, and I said, see, you're wrong, and you always will be wrong. The point being that if you give money to rich people, they don't spend it. They don't insert it into the economy. They just invest it, which is okay, but it doesn't help anyone else apart from the person and the company they invested it with. Whereas the barmaid would spend the money. She's moving the money around. She's injecting the money into the local economy, and that's the good thing. And I politely thanked him for his company and made my exit. And that was that. He's still going around talking about Reaganomics and the trickle-down economy and what a success it is, but that's just because he's greedy. And I went back to my room, and I slept very comfortably.
I have Sunitha Badiga in studio today. It's December 16th, 2020. And she is the founder of the home bakery, La Mala Sol. Hi, Sunitha.
Hi.
Well, I just ran into your page on Instagram and was instantly enchanted. I just have to admit to a baked goods addiction. And I'm looking at your stuff and realizing what a cool little thing you've created. And I like to feature people in the community who are starting their own businesses, you know, rather than the big companies. Why not the real people of LA who have bootstrap operations and are finding out how to create it themselves? So here we are. Why don't you tell us a little about how this all started.
So I grew up in this border town. It's called McAllen, Texas. And it's a small town. I mean, now it's become like a city. And I've always been interested in cooking and baking. And I kind of, you know, always did it my whole life. And when I ended up going to college in New York, I went to NYU. And I kind of got exposed to more like different foods and flavors and stuff. So I started bringing that home whenever I'd come home for the holidays and trying out new recipes and things like that for my family. And they would critique me pretty harshly and tell me what things were good and mainly what things were pretty horrible. And it was good. And I've always been interested in film. Film is really my background and my passion. So this year with the pandemic, when everything hit, I was trying to go into acting and do stand-up comedy, but everything kind of shut down. And I was trying to look for ways I could, you know, help out with COVID happening. You know, I was just sitting on my ass and I came down to Texas and I wasn't doing anything. I was spending time with my family and I decided to start baking and donating all of the funds that I got to Feeding America. And I ended up raising about $4,000, which was great for my small town. And I,
wow.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. And then I said, okay, like maybe this is a good side business or a side hustle. And so when I came back to LA, I started baking here. And I've had a few collaborations with businesses and, you know, the response has been great. And it's been fun. I've never been on the other side of a business where I've been running it. I've always been a customer. So that's been also pretty eye-opening as well.
Well, there's the creative part, coming up with all the recipes.
Yeah.
And then the business part, the two completely different things, but both can be creative.
Yeah.
And both have to be attended to.
Yeah. I think the thing people forget, and the thing I forget, is that you're doing everything. You're doing the business, you're doing the PR, you're trying to reach out to people and promoting things, and then you're also trying to stay relevant and come up with new things that people would like. But mainly I try to make things that I would like and what I would eat. And like I mentioned, like growing up in a small town, I didn't have like a lot of access to nice food or like interesting flavors or anything. Like all of that came whenever I travel or I would go to somewhere like a city and I get to try stuff. So whenever I was home in Texas, I'd really be trying to recreate whatever I couldn't have.
So there, that's just like a big vat of gruel that everybody eats.
No, actually, I think all
fast food is.
I mean, sure, we're actually top 10 for obesity in America.
Okay,
our town. It's on there. You can look it up.
It's something to be.
It's something. We're least educated and number one, like top 10 for obesity.
McAllen, Texas.
We're proud of it.
Incestual marriage.
Yes. No, well, it wasn't like that. I mean, growing up in a border town, we jokingly call it Mexico, Texas. Like, it's primarily Hispanic. So, in some ways, I had a lot of Hispanic influence, and I did have, like, a lot of great Hispanic foods that I learned to, like, appreciate when I was older. But when I was younger, I didn't really know where to go for those things, and I didn't. You know, there was only like cake you could buy at the grocery store, and it was like jam packed with sugar, and like, you know, it didn't taste like anything exciting. And so some of the best stuff that I tried, I was so lucky to have parents that loved traveling. So some of the best things I tried were on our trips where we traveled to like really unique places and such.
Well, you're Indian American. How do you get your masalas and samosas?
Yeah. So it's funny. My mom. Actually, I grew up, I was very lucky to grow up with a housekeeper who's Hispanic, and my mom and her would teach each other recipes. So a lot of the food that I had growing up was Mexican, was Indian, was like fusion somehow. And my mom grew up in Jamaica. So, and my grandparents live in Jamaica. So she's still Indian, but she grew up there. So like on Thursdays or Fridays, we'd have like jerk chicken.
Jerk chicken.
Yeah, we'd have jerk chicken, or we'd have like dumplings and festivals, which was like these fried breads and things like that. And a lot of like pepper jelly and things like that. So it was.
Wow.
Yeah. So definitely the food in the house that we were having was pretty unique compared to like another Indian American household or another household in the town that I was at.
Interesting how cultures can figure out how to get along through food.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people don't know, but there's a big Indian diaspora across the Caribbean, particularly in Jamaica, and my grandparents are still there. So we always have Jamaican food. And again, growing up on the border, Mexican food is so similar to Indian food. Like, the spices that we use and like the level.
Cumin.
Yeah, cumin. And even like the peppers and stuff, like, and the onions. Like, you know, actually in India, we usually use more yellow onions, but white onions are so common where we're from. So we started using white onions, which are a little bit stronger. And, you know, they use a lot of cilantro, we call coriander.
Right.
Yeah.
One's the leaf, one's the seed.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been really interesting. I think it's a unique childhood that I wouldn't trade for anything. And my parents are still there, and I visit often. So when I'm here, I bake, and I live here now because of acting and comedy. I actually moved out here for my master's in producing at USC, and I graduated last year. And so when I'm here, I do the baking. But when I'm home, I go home often. I also bake there, and I do pop-ups. So and both times it's well received, and I'm still donating part of the profits to Feeding America.
Wow, what a great vision. By the way, here's a little blow mind. Chilies are a new world vegetable. Chili's.
Yeah.
They were in the Americas.
Yeah.
They weren't in India until the 1700s.
Right.
There wasn't, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine some of these cuisines that use it all the time, Korean food, it wasn't there.
Right. I mean, it's just crazy the exchange of ideas. And as I get older, it's even more fascinating to see, like, how the world is so similar and how a lot of these countries and cuisines are so similar. And they're not so different after all.
So how has your past and this syncretic experience of all these cultures come together influenced your bakery?
Yeah, so I definitely try to incorporate a lot of these flavors. And again, it's like things that I'm craving or things that like I want to eat that I didn't, that maybe I don't have access to in the moment. And I'm like, oh, what am I craving? Like, what do I feel like having? And like, for example, I remember I had the opportunity to travel to Finland and we had cardamom rolls and instead of cinnamon rolls. And cardamom is such a big spice of India, and cinnamon rolls are like amazing. It's like, what could go wrong? It's like butter, sugar, and cinnamon. So I was like, I should try, you know, I was thinking of my trip when I was a kid, we did that trip and I was like, I really want that. So I made cardamom rolls, and right now that's like one of my best sellers is cardamom rolls with like an espresso glaze. And you know, when I was in New York, there was a bakery that would do chocolate cake with rose water, and I was craving that one day and I started doing that. And again, that's one of my best sellers is chocolate cake with a rose water buttercream. And, you know, another thing that I do is I incorporate cajeta, which is dulce leche, but it's made with goat's milk.
Oh.
And that's very common in Mexico and very common in my town. So a lot of the cakes I ate for celebrations often incorporated cajeta in between the layers. And it's delicious. It's like amazing. And I remember when I was older, I was thinking about it and I was like, wow, I really want like cake with cajeta. And so I started doing that with like a vanilla cake, cajeta, and a goat cheese frosting. So it's goat's milk and the dulce leche and then a goat cheese and the frosting with a brûlée fig. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So yum.
Yeah.
Keep going. What else do you make?
I have a fall and winter menu. So I did sweet potato cupcakes with a molasses buttercream. And again, like I love sweet potato. And I was thinking like, how can you make this? Like, for example, I always make sweet potato souffle for my mom. And I was thinking like, how can you make this into like a cake or a cupcake for people? So I started doing that, which has been a lot of fun. And I did speculoos, which is like gingerbread. Like it's a gingerbread, they call it cookie butter.
Oh, but is that like the German word?
Yes, it's the German.
Like pfeffernuss?
Yes, speculoos, which is, it's literally like cookie butter. It tastes like gingerbread cookies like melted together in a butter. And I started doing that sort of cake because I remember the first time I tried speculoos was when I was living in New York and they'd have it at Trader Joe's, the cookie butter. You could just spread it on your freaking toast and everybody was talking about it. And I was like, wow, what is this? And I became obsessed with it. So that's like another thing. But definitely the rolls are like my most popular, where I do like a Mexican hot chocolate roll as well. And that's just kind of like abuelita, which is like, you know, the nice dark hot chocolate that Mexicans drink often and Hispanics drink here. But I added a little bit of cayenne and adobo chili pepper. So it's like chocolate, but it has a good kick. It has like a good spice to it. And those are like in these really big rolls that have like a cream cheese glaze as well. So I try not to make things too sweet because I think the problem is that when you go to a bakery, you get stuff and all you taste is sugar and you can't distinguish the flavors. So when I make things, I try to make sure you can actually taste the flavor rather than just tasting cake or rather than just tasting cookie. Like you can taste like, hey, this is like a goat cheese frosting or hey, this is a lavender cake. Like you can distinguish it. So, yeah.
So amazing.
Yeah.
You know, my biggest complaint about baked goods is they put in too much salt, particularly in cookies. Mm-hmm. Like chocolate chip, I'm a chocolate chip cookie freak.
Yeah.
And it's too salty. What's the point? I don't know. Maybe you're
We'll disagree on this. I actually like the salt.
Okay.
This
is where we're having a problem right now in the interview. Okay, like whoever decided to start salting chocolate, see, that's just like wrong. That person should be, this is not a decent being for the planet. We won't get into the chili and chocolate issue. I can deal with that, but salt?
Yeah.
You've ruined a perfectly good food.
Well, the whole point of putting salt is to bring out the sweetness, right? It's supposed to complement it. And I think some people have gone overboard with that, especially with the Maldon salt, which is like this really bougie salt that everybody...
All flaky.
Yeah, right. Very flaky. But you know what's funny is that my dad... He doesn't eat any desserts or sugar. He doesn't really like much of what I bake. But I make these chocolate chunk cookies where I put the Maldon salt in it. And he loves them. And he's like, oh my God, I've never tasted anything like this before. And it's fascinating to me because it's such a like modern take on a chocolate chip cookie. But he loves it. And it's the salt that does it for him, the sea salt. Mm. So
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you grew up with them, that's why.
I guess I can't be right about everything. But I, you know, Mystic Pete, I'm pretty psychic, actually. And one of my, so I'm really into baked goods. I mean, And one of my psychic abilities is actually psychic baked good detection. Okay, I can go into a city, like the first time, within 10 minutes, I can be the best bakery in town. Boom. This is like a real mystical ability I have. You know, I can't like float in the air or disappear. Reading minds a little bit, but this bakery thing, very strong in the blood.
Yeah. that's a good you know. Gene to have. Yeah. I wish I had that. I didn't.
But if there has been any silver lining to this epoch of tragedy, we are hopefully near the end of in December of 2020, the year that most people wish didn't happen. It's that people have gotten back into artisanal baking and crafts, and like sourdough bread making is like a big thing. And it's really nice to see people investing their time and figuring out these ancient practices that just bring so much richness to life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the lights in the very dark, dark tunnel of 2020 was, you know, being able to do this. And one of my favorite things is probably not even the baking. I don't even know if I enjoy the baking. It's as much as seeing people how happy and grateful they are, you know, getting to try different things that they've never tasted before and unique things, which is my goal. I'd rather you questioning, you know, what you're tasting and you know, what is this flavor? Like, what is that? And trying new things. But also I've seen so many people kind of start home businesses like this to support themselves, like whether it's been in LA or whether it's been in my small town in McAllen. And it's been really fun to watch like people get creative and to see like what they can put out there instead of, you know, going to like a Starbucks, but, you know, seeing what you can do with your own two hands. And yeah, like you mentioned about people trying to make bread. I had so many friends who tried to do it, and it was funny, over the summer, I couldn't find yeast. Yeast was sold out everywhere. I had to buy it off eBay. I had to buy like a $20, like 1 pound thing of yeast because people were just making so much.
They were hoarding
bread.
Yeast.
They were hoarding yeast.
The great yeast run of 2020.
Exactly.
You know, along with toilet paper.
Exactly. But it's been good. I'm glad like people have been able to, I think, kind of go back to, if you can say your roots, like go back to cooking at home and finding the beauty in that. And it's so hard to do that when people have full-time jobs, which, you know, causes them to work away from home or makes them go somewhere else. But at least if you're working from home, you might have a little bit more time to appreciate that and be able to cook for yourself or your family or your loved ones and really enjoy the process.
I think you saw this in the 60s and 70s with the hippie movement, and people started getting into macrame and home birth.
Right, I mean, just
rediscovering all these ancient arts and practices.
Yeah.
And I was into all that kind of stuff. And it was like the Whole Earth Catalog.
Right.
It just taught you how to do all this homemade stuff. Make your own beer. I've made my own beer.
Yeah.
I still have one bottle from my original brew in the 90s.
Can you see after you drink that? Is it
legal? I did go blind for a couple of months. There's that.
Well, I think now everybody's trying to make kombucha.
Yeah, so, no, that's another evil
thing.
Please don't even say that on my radio. I don't know who came up with that and stopped trying to get me to drink this foul vinegary. Who came up with drinking vinegar? That's a thing.
There's no vinegar in it, actually.
Okay.
There's no, but yeah, you know, my parents feel the same way. They're like, how can you drink that? And
I
know, I hated it when I first tried it, but then it became like addicting.
Oh, so you're drinking?
Yeah, I chug it.
Sunitha.
I chug it with
the salt in the cookies and the kombucha.
Yeah, I used to really hate it. Like,
wow. And I thought this was going to go better.
I definitely don't advise people to make their own. Please don't. You will definitely go
kombucha?
Blind.
Yeah.
It's so dangerous to make your own. Please don't.
Well, your bakery is La Mala Soul. So you can be found on Instagram, baked by LA period Mala period Soul.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes. And you can even search La Mala Soul and I'm sure it'll come up. And, you know, I'm taking orders through my DM right now because it's been a limited amount. But hopefully I can transition into everybody ordering online down the road. So.
And I think we've gotten so used to just eating packaged goods, packaged baked goods. And look, I need my baked goods. If I can't have it, my dessert after dinner, I'm not doing well. So I have some packaged baked goods there for an emergency.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Homemade, artisanal food cooked by somebody who loves what they're doing, and every batch is a little different, and it just feels so good. And this is what I love.
Yeah,
so good. For like, it feeds a different part of us than just our tummy.
Yeah, definitely. I think sometimes I have people complain about my prices and I'm like, well, I think the beauty of it is like trying to use the best ingredients, like trying to use ingredients that are sourced locally and that are good for us. And, you know, I think that's the most important thing, because you're feeding yourself and you want to taste something and it's got to taste good. Like, if you're going to spend the money, like, don't get like a really cheap Chips Ahoy cookie. Get a really nice cookie that's warm and like melts in your mouth. I think that's,
The cheap oils that are the real gross thing.
Yeah,
about
I think that too. And just like being mass manufactured, like you don't get that same thing if like your mom made cookies for you or someone from scratch. And I think there's a real taste, there's a real difference in like when you try those things, or even with cakes, like compared to like, you know, corn syrup and all this other crap that they put in there, it's different when you're using like just regular like flour, butter, like butter-based cakes and things like that.
Butter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. All my stuff is dripping in butter, by the way.
So I love it. No, that's another, you know, I'm on my like ranting interview complaining about well, the thing I don't like is, and I used to be a professional cook. I've cooked in restaurants. I have my own catering company, by the way. The oils out there, safflower, corn, soy, and canola, my body doesn't experience those as food.
Yeah.
I mean, I can get away with a few French fries or this or that, but I'll get just in a, it's like grease in my body.
Yeah.
I can drink a half a cup of olive oil and be happy.
Yeah.
Or butter. But that's not actually vital, nutritious products that I want to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Ironically, you know, I don't eat refined sugar. So I don't eat sugar. And when I do, I want it to be something really good and worth it.
Yes.
Exactly. And that's what I hope, like, the same thing for whoever is buying my goods. It's like, I want them to be like, wow, this was worth it. This was, like, worth whatever occasion you have or whatever. If you're having a cheat day, you just feel like freaking having a cookie. Like, it was worth it for you.
Yeah.
And you can definitely taste the difference when you use things that are not of quality. You know, there's some things that probably won't make a difference, but when you use, like, good chocolate, that makes such a difference compared to if you were using, like, you know, your run-of-the-mill, like, Nestle or Toll House and stuff like that.
Yeah, just the low... Well, what kind of chocolate do you use?
I use Ghirardelli, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, Ghirardelli is, like,
the
best
kind. So you pay for the good stuff?
I pay for the good stuff.
That's why your food is good.
Yes.
What's the future for a La Mala Sol? So, like, some international conglomerate that's in every Safeways in the planet?
You know, I'm kind of going with the flow. I didn't expect it to... I never would have imagined that I would have created a home bakery and a business. When I started, like I mentioned, in March, I just did this as like a relief, like a fundraising situation. And now it's become a business and very successful, which has been great. And my passion lies with acting and comedy, but I'm still passionate about the baking as well. So, you know, if I were to own maybe a brick and mortar store one day, that would be great, but we'll see what happens.
A little store.
Yeah.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah. A cute little store. Yes.
What advice would you have for someone starting a bakery business? They have wonderful cookies they make that are not too salty. Let's just say that. What do they do?
Yeah, I think it's especially, it depends on your location. And I think coming to LA and trying to do this business has been hard. But, you know, you just got to kind of put your head down and do the work and get advice from people. That's what I did. Whenever I see someone really successful on Instagram who's doing, a great baking business or a home bakery, I reach out to them and I'm like, hey, how did you do this? And do you have any advice for starting out? And I've gotten some good responses. I've also had some harsh responses because it's LA. And people are kind of mean. And, you know, in the beginning, I was like, oh, I need to get influencers. I need to get these people to promote my things. And that was kind of the wrong thing because I think everybody's kind of out for themselves. So, you know, just cook with your heart, bake with your heart. And the main purpose of this is so people can enjoy your baking and so you can also enjoy what you're doing. So just stick to that and everything else will come pretty naturally. But, you know, don't be afraid to reach out to people for advice. And you'd be surprised, like, the people that will respond to you. And, you know, most of the time they are willing to help you out and give you advice.
Fabulous Baked Goods by Sunitha Badiga, founder of the home bakery Baked by La Mala Sol, and that's how you can be found on Instagram, Baked by La.Mala.Sol.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
You know those albums that if they hadn't been there to lift you over some really hard times, you might not even be here? Well, Suite for Flute and Jazz Piano Trio by Claude Bowling with Jean-Pierre Rampal on flute was one such album for me. I found it in the early 80s when it was a rough time in my life and played that piece of vinyl over and over and over, and it saw me through some deep valleys. I'm sad to report that Claude Bowling just died. Claude Bowling was born in 1930. He was a French jazz pianist, a composer, arranger, and occasional actor. He wrote for over 100 films and was noted for a series of crossover collaborations with classical musicians. His suite for flute and jazz piano trio with Jean-Pierre Rampal on flute was a mix of baroque elegance with modern swing, and has been a top seller for many years. In case you've never heard this extraordinary suite for flute and jazz piano trio, I'm going to play you a couple of my favorite selections. In a moment, we'll hear Sentimental, followed by a couple of lovely short stories, the first one by Helen Torres called Speaking Up, and then a story by Gray Delisle Griffin called Finding My Voice. And then we'll hear the tune Erlandes. By the way, Helen Torres and Gray Delisle Griffin are part of an event put on by the Passionistas Project to celebrate the inauguration of our country's first female multiracial vice president, Kamala Harris. You can find out more information at thepassionistasproject.com. It's January 17th at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So here now, music by Claude Bowling, Sentimental. Thank you.
My mother was a single mother in Puerto Rico, a beautiful island, a commonwealth of the United States. And she had to work really hard in the garment industry in Puerto Rico. I was born with a heart defect and disease, and she was advised to come to the United States to ensure I had the best care. Everyone knew that eventually I would have to have open heart surgery by the age of 12. And some of the best doctors happened to be in Detroit, Michigan, where also I had an aunt and uncle were living. So it made it easy somewhat for her to migrate to the United States. But it was really difficult for her. And as her daughter, I witnessed the struggles she had with people accepting her accent. As she was learning English, she was made fun of a lot. People ridiculing her, correcting her. And just little by little, you saw this very independent woman just being her spirit been chipped away at. When my mother remarried and our stepfather moved us out to the suburbs, she even had a harder time because in Detroit, we at least had a community of fellow Puerto Ricans and Mexicanos that we could talk, she would at least have friendships with. But it was when she went outside of that community, taking me to my hospital visits, doing banking transitions, trying to get a job is where things really kind of, it showed me the level of, I would quite think, frankly say, discrimination that so many people face. When we moved to the suburbs, that even multiplied because we moved into a very blue collar, very lovely in so many ways, but blue collar, 100% Caucasian. I'll give you an example. When I graduated from high school, our high school itself had 2,000 people. I think we were 4 Latino families out of those 2,000. So it just gives you a sense of the isolation she was feeling. And I always say there's this one moment in my history that crystallized, I think, my pathway into advocacy and being very passionate about people being included and ensuring that we have an inclusive society. I was in third grade. It was the first year that I was going to a public school. I went to Catholic school up till that point. And my mother received a call from another mother that was organizing some kind of bake sale or something for the school. And there was something lost in translation. My mother just understood that she was asked to bring a cake. So she baked this beautiful cake. When she showed up at the cake, the mother that was organizing on this just really yelled at her saying, I meant cupcakes, not a cake. You have to learn how to speak English. And even at that age, being a third grader, I step in between them and I yelled at the woman saying, how dare you? My mother knows 2 languages and these are beautiful cupcakes. And I think that's where the advocate in me started. It's crazy to think even in third grade, you can see some injustice. So I always think of that incident and I experienced similar changes in my mom. She went through her own stage of depression. And it wasn't until I was in college that I really started getting more involved and political and started really understanding the need to understand how the system works and the part that I can play in it. But at the end of the day, I found hope. The organization I run as a place to ensure what happened to my mother doesn't happen to other Latinas. Now, of course, we're not 100% in making that happen, but I feel like I'm working towards that. And that's why I'm so passionate. My mom is still very politically active. She's still my role model in so many ways. But I often think, she wasn't given an opportunity for a formal education. And I think how many women in our society have not been given that, especially of different generations, and just the waste of human capital that if we don't invest in each other, what does that mean to our society? And the beautiful part is when we do invest in each other, the lovely things that come out of it.
My voice is a huge part of who I am as a person, and it's always been a part of my life. when I was little, I used to do weird voices, you know, just weird little impressions. And my grandmother raised me on her own, and she worked in a factory long hours, and there wasn't a lot to keep me busy. So she bought me a boombox, and I would do just like little radio plays for myself and just do strange little voices all the time. And I didn't really know you could actually make a living at it, but now I do make a living at it. I do cartoon voices for a living.
I play little girls like this, and I play little old ladies that talk a little bit like that, and you know, queens and all kinds of royal people, and like 14-year-old boys and stuff that like skateboard and stuff.
Anyway, my voice is a big, giant part of who I am. I'm also a singer-songwriter, and I come from a very musical family. My grandmother used to sing with the Latin band leader Tito Puente, and my mom was in bands, and so there's always been music and voices ringing through our home. And my grandmother taught me a lot of great things, but she also instilled with me a terrible sense of vanity. Like, if I wasn't wearing lipstick, you know, I mean, just, she would go,
"Ay, mijita, you look like you're dead. You look like you're dead. Put some lipstick on."
I was only 8 years old at the time, so it was really sad. No, I'm kidding. She did pierce my ears when I was, I think, 1 year old, but we'll talk about that another time. Anyway, vanity was a big deal. And I just, I wish I didn't care what people think of me so much. You know, it's something I'm always still working on. I go to a job where nobody sees me, but I'm always really overdressed just because I want to make a good impression. It's hard for me to find my authentic voice. It's even hard for me to sound like myself. Sometimes directors say, "Hey, Gray, can you, you know, just use your normal voice for this?" And I always have a little tiny panic attack going, "Oh, my God, what is that? What is my normal voice? Do you want this? Or do you want this? Or like, you know, what?" And I was like, "What is my normal voice?" I also don't tell people what I feel a lot. It's hard because I want them to like me and I want to make a good impression. I sometimes don't say exactly how I'm really feeling. And my friends actually joke about that a lot because they'll ask me if something's okay. We'll be making plans for something and they'll say, "Is that a good plan, Grace? Should we, you know, is that a good thing we should do? Are you okay with that?" And I'll go, "Okay, yeah. And then they know that I really am not cool with that plan because they go, "Oh," sometimes they'll say, "Is it really okay, Gray, or is it like high voice okay?" And it really calls me out. I'm like, "Oh, God, you're right. Sorry, I guess that it really isn't a good plan for me." Anyway, so although I use my voice as my job, it is hard for me to find my voice when I really want to tell someone how I feel or what I think, and I don't, and I want them to like me. There was also a creepy relative that sort of crossed some boundaries when I was little. And so that was another thing that, you know, I kind of lost my voice in that way. And it kind of brought me up at this environment where I just wanted to make people happy and just kind of fly under the radar and not upset anyone. And anyway, so it's carried on into my adult life. And a prime example of that was when I was at my local nail salon that I've been going to for like 20 years. And I love the lady who does my nails, Nancy. We've been through marriages and divorces and kids graduating and all kinds of great things together. And I feel like, you know, we know each other really well, but I still also want to make a really good impression on her. And I don't want her to not like me. But one day I was really stressed out and she goes, "You know, Gray, we do little massages here and they're not very expensive. Do you want to get them?" And I thought, "That sounds wonderful." And she's, so, you know, there was a little shower curtain in the corner of the salon with this little, you know, shower pole. And it was kind of a rinky-dink setup, but it wasn't very expensive. And I trusted Nancy. And so, you know, we went back there and she's like, "Just, you know, strip down to your underwear and just lay on your stomach and I'll be in a second." So she came in and I'm ready to go. She puts her little music on. And first off, she starts using this lotion that's just really perfumey, and I have like a real sensitivity to scents. I really hate colognes and stuff like that, but I was like, "Nancy, do you mind if, is there any other kind of lotion? Because I just, it's going to make me really sick if you," and so then I'm already a pain in the butt, you know. But she accommodates me. She goes and gets like some kind of oil. I guess it was just sort of like a vegetable oil or something that had no scent to it. So she starts massaging me again, and at one point, she's getting really close to my boobs. You know, it's just getting a little bit, you know, a lot, just a little too close for comfort on the boobs. And she would just get real close. And then I would think, oh, I'm going to have to say something. Oh, you know, and then she would kind of like massage away and, you know, go down the sides of my, you know, my sides and everything. And so then I turn over and she's really getting in there on the boobs. You know, it's just sort of grazing. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to say something. I think I need to say something. But then she would, you know, go away again. And then she was just getting really, really close. And at one point, she just went round and round all over the boobs. And I was like, oh, no, it's happening. Oh, my goodness. But of course, you know, I'm not letting on at all that I'm not okay with this. You know, so I'm like kind of, you know, just like really stiffening up and just like my eyes are shut tighter than ever. And I'm thinking, just be quiet. It'll be done in a second. I'm sure she won't, you know, linger there as soon as, you know, and then she wouldn't linger. She would go back, you know, and start massaging other parts of my body, you know. And I thought to myself, okay, if it happens again, I'm going to have to go, Nancy, please, you know, I don't really want my boobs rubbed. But then I think, okay, I'm not going to have to say anything because, you know, she's not going back there. And then sure enough, here she comes again and she's doing it again. And I just cannot summon the strength inside I don't want to hurt her feelings. I'm already a pain because I had to have the special oil and I just don't want to say it. And I just keep freezing up and hoping that it'll just be done soon, even though I'm paying, you know, money to be really uncomfortable for, you know, 20 minutes or whatever. And the funny thing is that she actually asked me, she was like, is that okay, Gray? And I was like, uh-huh, yeah, that's good. But she doesn't know the high voice is not real. She doesn't know the high voice thing. So she just keeps going because I still haven't told her how I really feel. And then she starts to go toward my face. And my face is really sensitive. If there's any kind of products or oil or whatever, I sound like so high maintenance. It's like I can't have the scents. I don't like the thing on my face. But it's true. I break out if anything gets on my face. So the whole time she's rubbing my face, all I'm thinking is, oh, God, I should have said something. Now I'm going to have cystic acne for a week. But I still didn't say anything. And then she went for the hair. I am a part Mexican woman, and I have very curly Mexican hair that I spend a lot of time relaxing and flat ironing and blow drying within an inch of its life. And I really only wash my hair once a week because it just takes so long to get it to where it's not frizzy and curly and crazy. And I just really, my hair means a lot. It's very important. I get it really nice and straight. And at one point, Nancy starts coming toward the hair with the oily hands, and I just found my voice. I just said, Nancy, please, can you, I don't really want the oil in my hair. It'll take me hours to get it back to how it is now. Can you please not? And she was startled because I think I had smashed down what I wanted for so long before I was able to tell her. And of course she was totally fine with it because she's Nancy and we've been friends forever. And of course she just wants to do a good job and make me happy as much as I want to make her happy. And that was the day that my grandmother and vanity helped me find my voice.
We are coming to the end of the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com. We started with a story by Steve Payne called Laffer, then an interview I did with Sunitha Bediga, who has a bakery called La Mala Sol, then stories by Helen Torres. She leads one of the nation's most influential Latina organizations called HOPE, H-O-P-E. That story was called Speaking Up. And then a story by Gray Delisle Griffin, who is a Grammy-winning singer-songwriter, who is known as the most prolific voice actress in American animation history, having performed over 1,500 cartoon voices since 1996. Her story was called Finding My Voice. And the pieces we heard by Claude Bowling were Sentimental and Irlandaise. Thank you for your beautiful music, Claude. Mystic Pete out.